It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions 18+. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass student Maura Murray drove from her dorm in Amherst, Massachusetts to the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
At approximately 7:27 p.m., Maura spun out her 1996 Saturn on a hairpin turn on Route 112 in North Haverhill. There has never been a credible sighting of Maura since.
Maura is 5'7" tall. She weighs 120 pounds, and she has brown hair and hazel eyes.
If you have any information regarding Maura's disappearance, please submit it to us, the Murray family, through their Facebook page, or the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit.
This is Missing Maura Murray. Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space Wormtown Studios. How are you, Lance?
I'm doing very well. How are you today?
I'm doing great today. And we have a conversation with the lovely Maggie Freeling of Oxygen's The Disappearance of Maura Murray to bring to you in just a little bit. We will be talking about what we did up in New Hampshire a couple weeks ago when we joined GB Geotechnics, Ed and Graham, the GPR guys, and a few others, including a cadaver dog up in the White Mountains area to do some investigating.
And we know that Maggie is very busy. She has a very busy lifestyle, and she was not able to make it up there with us, and she regretted that. She really wanted to be there, but as schedules sometimes go, she wasn't able to do so. So we needed to give her the rundown about what happened, figured it would be a good time to simultaneously give the audience a rundown as well.
Right, yeah. We hadn't talked to Maggie before this about it, so we recorded, and so that is the experience that you will be getting in the second half of this episode. But the first half of this episode, Lance, we will be sort of responding to the reaction from the lovely community about the Curtis Murray episode.
One of the episodes that has generated the most chatter and feedback, primarily positive and supportive of Kurt and us. And it's funny, actually funny, because the ones that aren't are almost insane. It was the only time I looked at the comments and actually thought, why are you writing this? Because sometimes, you know, you can write a comment about something that really, you know, you could have an opinion that is very aggressively negative, but it blows my mind that anybody would consider writing something negative about anything that Curtis Murray said.
Right. And so there were a lot of positive comments, and we will get into those, but I think you kind of mentioned this one specifically, and let me just read that one. It came on YouTube, and it's from an asterisk, and it says, if Mora was...
Back up 1 second. From
yeah.
What?
Yeah, you heard me. It's from just an asterisk. It says, if Mora was my sister, the top three suspects on the suspect list would already have been knocked off, and I would have an airtight alibi.
That's incredible. So let's real quick break down what he's saying.
Please.
Here, or she. Mm-hmm. Asterisk is saying to take the top three suspects in a disappearance case that doesn't have a body yet and then off them and make sure you have an airtight alibi. Basically, inviting Curtis Murray to create a kill list and execute it.
Yeah, he says that's what he would do.
That's what he would do.
Sister went missing. He or she. We don't know. Obviously, that is sort of an aggressive reaction to this episode.
Sort of.
And not like most comments we got that was like this wonderful person who said, that was amazing to listen to. Thank you, Curtis. From Samira on YouTube. The last thing that interview with Curtis should do is inspire violence.
That's why it's just insane. That's why I said I look at that and I'm laughing because it's just insane to write that.
I mean, maybe the person meant it in jest. I don't know, but not really the most appropriate comment. Now, here's another one that came in on YouTube, and it said, I don't think Mora Murray existed, from Graham. Not Graham from GB Geotechnics. Just kind of an unnecessary comment. And we're not here to chastise people who are commenting on YouTube. We're just trying to talk about their reaction and how they run the gambit. Here's another one that was interesting. Brianna says, anyone search the dump that Tim worked at the time? Also kind of an interesting reaction to the conversation, because Curtis said he's fairly certain Tim had nothing to do with it. I mean, he kind of guaranteed it personally anyway, and happened to mention in passing that Tim worked at a dump, but someone recognized that and went for it to ask a question about it.
I'll give an answer to that. Well, I would think that,
yeah, sure.
I would think that just with our relationship with Chuck West and the state police now, I would think that they've searched areas like that. It wouldn't surprise me if they did search that dump, but we don't know for sure. But we do know, based on their work ethic that they've put in the last few years, last several years, that I would guess that they have.
From Allie, she says, I hate this case. As I try to solve it, you realize that the Murray family is real and that they have to go through the real pain. We pretend we have a theory, but this poor family has to live through every theory. I'm sorry, Kurt.
Just to follow up on that, similar comment from Dan. I appreciate him giving this interview. Gives me a bit of a different perspective on Mora and the rest of the family. He humanizes them, and that's something that we have been talking about, and I'm glad the people get that.
Yeah. Sarah says, Kurt, I just want to say a massive thank you for letting us get some insight into your family life. We all want to find out what happened to Mora, and I hope your family will get closure one day. She will be found. And that's nice.
Yeah, that's very nice. And I want people to know that we didn't do this interview to exploit Curtis. He had been dealing with this for a while, and he had that moment by the tree, by the accident site, that he just broke down and he realized that he had to pick up the torch and carry it for the family, because he knows his dad's not going to be able to do it or Fred is not going to be able to do it forever. So he wanted to be more involved with this, and it is emotional for him now.
Yeah. Well, honestly, that was emotional for, I think, every listener to hear that part, especially.
Absolutely.
In being here in person, it was a different experience than hearing it, because we can cut out all the pauses. But Lance, we said after the interview, we've never had that many pauses after like a topic. And then we kind of move on, and it's like we just sat here in like silence, speechless for like 10 seconds, and then we'd move on. But we've literally never done an interview that went like that.
Yeah, it's because we've never had someone like him looking at us in the eye and telling us these things that his family has approved him to say, and just raw emotion on top of that.
And from Kimberly, she says, this was an emotional episode. Thank you, Kurt, for coming on and giving us more of a personal view of Mora, Fred, and all of you kids. And your mom, bless her heart. Don't lose faith. She will be found and brought home. I can relate to Kathleen. I know firsthand what she went through with her fiance. Like Lance said, it's a ghost that you forever chase, no matter how old you are. And she thanks us for doing this interview and keeping Maura in the public eye. Well, thank you for the comment and for listening and being really responsible with your comment. That was great.
And I think the overall message that these positive comments have, I just read one here from Kim, and she ended, "We won't give up on Maura," with an exclamation point. That's really the overall theme of the comments that have come through, is that good for you, Kurt, for coming on and talking to us, and you know that we're still out here and we still support you and we won't give up on this. And from one of our dedicated followers and friend, really, Dan, sent an email which was forwarded to Curtis so that he could see, you know, a real pure reaction that people have. Dan sort of has a voice for an entire community. A lot of what he says really is from a community standpoint in this case. He said he just took his glasses off because he can't stop sobbing over Curtis's incredible resilience and valuable perspective. And he thanks everybody who's involved with this. And he just says that with full confidence, this was the single most important interview ever done about Maura's case. And it was a huge thing to say. And even if he's complimenting us because he wants to know that it was a good interview, or if he actually thinks that it was the most important interview done on Maura's case, it's important in the sense that we didn't talk about crazy speculations and theories. We went back to the humanizing of the whole of Maura and the family.
Right.
And I think that's what made it important.
Yeah, I think so. And the community really responded. And so we got a few other emails, not necessarily regarding that episode, but we just wanted to touch on a few more of those. So we got one from Kevin. He says, "Why do I not hear more discussion or speculation on Butch and his wife? No one brings up the idea the wife was covering for him and or in on what he could have done. Captured her, held her against her will. The wife watched her while he went out and helped them search, and he later moved on or disposed of her somewhere else. Sounds plausible. A loved one in a rural area where some odd people may live, that this could happen." What's your response to this one?
I think it would be better if you put wild in front of speculation. It does seem possible, but that is wildly speculating, and that's just not what we do. That's why you don't hear it.
That's pretty much it. I mean, the chances that Butch is completely clean here is far outweighs the very small odds I would give it that Butch knows what happened to Maura, or knew what happened to Maura before he passed, or his wife knows what happened.
Yeah. There are plenty of YouTube videos out there that cover theories and speculation on this, and that's something that a couple years ago you and I decided that we weren't going to do. So,
but check out the episodes from 3 years ago, because we were doing it then.
We might have speculated a little bit.
Someone named Merlin emailed us, said, "Fresh set of eyes. This case is way too interesting. Fantastical, dramatic, extreme. While truth is often stranger than fiction, everyday life and the majority of existence is disappointingly predictable. In addition to the local Cretans, who could be blamed for almost anything, New Hampshire also hosts wolves and bears. Wolves eat everything, bones too. It's not surprising no remains have been found. If I were a young woman with a half a buzz, I would leave the scene of that accident, hide a little ways into the woods, wait for the flashing lights to go by, and unless you fall down an old well, there are a lot of them in New England, you could climb up a tree." And the person kind of goes on a little bit and says there's nothing wrong with a little pontification. Just keep in mind that the world is a whole lot less mysterious than we give it credit for most of the time. And I think that is something that we can agree with.
Agree 100%.
On. Yeah. You know, chances are this mystery is a lot less mysterious than some of the theories that we've talked about on this podcast, or that the community has, or something like that. Chances are it's very simple, right?
Absolutely. And we do appreciate emails like this. This person says here, "I do enjoy a good yarn. There's nothing wrong with a little pontification," and that's, or pontificating. that, and that's cool, because sometimes we can go through something like this and say, you know what, we never considered wolves. We never considered this. We never considered this. And we look into it and we figure out how it may or may not be the case. You know, in the case of wolves or bears especially, they're hibernating. So you can probably check that off the list. And then you go back to, you know, whether or not there was footprints going into the woods and no clothes. I mean, I know wolves apparently eat bones too, but do they eat backpacks and alcohol bottles too? You know, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
But it does cause you to go back and keep things fresh and reevaluate stuff. So keep those emails coming. Just, you know, don't make them violent about going out and killing everybody that's a that's on your suspect list.
Yeah. From Pam, she says, I have a far-fetched idea. Would it be possible at all, after all these years, to take a scent dog to different areas of interest, smell something of Mara's that hasn't been washed, and see if there's a scent? If her backpack phone is somewhere, could it still have a scent on it? Would the car still have her scent? Could these things have been kept as a trophy and be found by scent dogs, is where she's going with it.
Sure, that's sort of what we're doing now.
Yeah.
We really are. We took cadaver dogs there. We brought GPR, the ground penetrating radar, to see if there was anything like a backpack or clothing or a cell phone.
And Pam goes on to say, lastly, I have listened in the past few weeks and I often have the creepiest thought that the killer most likely has listened to every single word of your podcasts. The image of him nodding yes or shaking his head no at the different avenues that were explored is terrifying and infuriating at the same time. And I think that's an interesting point. And I don't, well, obviously we have no idea if that's true. We obviously don't even know if Mara was killed.
I agree with Pam on this, that the thought of someone who might be responsible for something here is listening. And that is the power of the community and the listening audience and what we're doing with this. If they hear that every other week or once a month or whenever, but it's consistent that there are groups going up there and searching and digging. Don't go digging recklessly, but you know what I'm talking about. If there's activity surrounding this case, they know that there's always a buzz. They might just go and screw up. They might have tried to hide something that now they need to recover. There are people watching people all over the place up there. There's law enforcement watching people, listening to the show, reporting, and watching. And it just has to keep going.
But if someone out there who knows something is listening, we would implore them to please contact the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit. But also, if they'd like to send us something, email us something, they know they can trust us. And if you have something to send to us physically, you can send it to our P.O. Box.
And something new, Tim, for Missing Maura Murray and Crawl Space, we have a post office box. We have a mailing address that you can officially mail us letters, fan mail mostly. So I got a giant P.O. box when I went down to the post office, the biggest one they had for all the fan mail.
Okay.
Yep. So anyone who wants to send us correspondence, you can send that to 22 Front Street, P.O. Box 230, Worcester, Massachusetts 01614. And you can address that to Crawl Space Media or Missing Maura Murray or our names.
Okay, this one's from Pessy. She says, I'm a big fan of the podcast, started listening about 2 months ago, and I'm currently watching The Oxygen Show. She says, in Chris Peek's article, which I have pasted below, he writes that Cecil Smith was driving sedan 002 and that Butch Atwood and Faith Westman emphatically state that the car was a sedan and not an SUV. I know Cecil says he was in SUV 001, but is it possible he is mistaken? Also, it is possible that he indeed was in SUV 001, but that the 002 sedan that Faith and Butch Atwood saw was the first on the scene before. So could you respond to this? And so the interesting thing about this is Chris Peek is actually an old friend of mine. And so we went to high school together and he wrote this article because we started the podcast and he really liked it. And so he kind of got involved a little bit. So I can definitely say that there's no like conspiracy with Chris Peek or anything like that. He wrote the article before The Oxygen Show and before Cecil and the state's official response was that Cecil was in 001. So I think when Chris wrote that Cecil was in 002, I don't remember it necessarily being emphatically stated by Butcher or Faith, but when he wrote that, that was not with the information that the state had given the public that Cecil was first to arrive in the SUV 001.
And I've met Chris, and he's not at all someone who would put something out there to incite any sort of confusion or an agenda. It was just like you said, it was a lack of information and or bad information at the time.
Yeah, it was in the information out at the time. And actually, we had Chris on the podcast in an episode called Examining Original Articles. And we kind of talk about exactly this a lot. We talk about how journalists can get things wrong and how time can change facts and make it look like something's a lot more suspicious than it really is. So actually, it's like perfect full circle from that episode with this email.
And we have an interesting question / observation from Lauren. She has this rag in the tailpipe theory that has been stuck with her for a little while and basically says Fred had told Maura to put the rag in the tailpipe if you needed to prevent the car from smoking. And he said, you know, if you're driving around campus or whatever, you see like a campus police, you know, put the rag in the tailpipe, and wasn't good advice to give, but it was, you know, enough to get you past, say, a police officer. So Lauren says, if that's true, wouldn't the reason for her putting the rag in her tailpipe be because she saw a cop and was trying to avoid being pulled over? I'm not certain about but I think we can say that probably wasn't the case. If you're considering the time and night that she was driving, it was dark. I don't know where she would have seen a police officer on that road unless they were maybe coming out from another road. And I don't know how that police officer would see her car smoking to such a point.
Well, I think it's too late.
And it's also too late.
That, I think, is the main point. Like, if she was driving, got off the highway, and the car was smoking, and she saw a cop then, like, that would be the moment where the cop was going to pull her over. You know, not a second sighting with a cop that she would probably be concerned with. But who knows, really?
Right. You also have to consider how long the rag would stay in the tailpipe if she's driving before it just pops out.
Yeah.
So it would have to be pretty close to the crash site. So it would have to happen around, say, the Swiftwater way station.
Yeah, or the beginning of 112.
So it's a really, I like where Lauren's head's going. I love reading these theories and these, you know, sort of reasonings that people are coming up with. I think one of the rag in the tailpipe theories that we like is that the flurry of activity that Faith saw was Maura getting the rag, putting it in her tailpipe because she thought maybe her car could get over the snow embankment and give it a little more power, a little more sort of oomph to get it over. And as always, I would like to reiterate the fact that we know that this case arouses a lot of curiosity and people want to go up there. They want to take pictures. They want to research as much as possible, especially in the area. Please be respectful to that community and to the people who own those homes that is out there publicly now that we've searched. There's nothing that you're going to see there by just driving by and taking pictures that hasn't been seen or a picture hasn't been taken of in the past 14 and a half years. Also, we just wanted to give a big thanks to the people who own those homes and a big thanks to the community for allowing us to go up there and do that. And Bob, if you're listening, next time we're in the area, we will take you up on the offer to have your wife cook us a wonderful dinner.
Okay, here's another email from Courtney. I have followed this story from the beginning and also the podcast. Today I tuned into the documentary on Amazon. I can't help but be extremely bothered by the comments regarding the nature of Maura and Fred's relationship. I do not understand why there are comments stating that it's weird that they shared a tent while hiking or a motel room. I'm a year younger than Maura and connect with her immensely because she seemed close with her father.
Then she goes on to say, when I saw the Disappeared episode, it broke my heart thinking of my dad going through that if he lost my sister or me. So that really, you know, resonates with people who have, you know, a similar family situation.
Yep. And she says there's nothing weird about it. And she says there's nothing weird about her and her dad's experiences. And they hung out in New Hampshire as well. When you have a close relationship, that is what it is. And it's not weird.
It is the way you present it, though, the way you word it and say, that just doesn't sit well. You say that they're, you know, camping together and they're in the same tent, and then you just let that hang and you let the listener put together their own conclusions. So it's good to know that we have people out there who are watching and listening, and they're able to think for themselves with that.
Yeah, and so this was in Finding Maura Murray in one of the episodes, probably episode one she's referring to. And, I think the point of these episodes, Lance, isn't so much to display the facts about the case. as we've talked about, if you want like straight facts about the case, the Oxygen show, The Disappearance of Maura Murray, is really the place to go if you want to see the visual of that. If you want to hear stories about people who are obsessed with the case, that's why you come to Amazon Prime to check out Finding Maura Murray, because that's mainly the focus of our docuseries.
And that's really what this whole case is about. There's many facets to it, but two of the biggest are the case itself and the details of the investigation and the community that is involved in this that is very passionate about getting answers, whether it's responsible or not. But those are the two like main things that drive this story.
So what we're showing in Finding Maura Murray kind of runs the gamut. It kind of shows the entire spectrum of obsession into Maura Murray's disappearance, and us as characters in the beginning are really just at the beginning of our spectrum.
And as we're working on the future episodes and we're going through all the footage, really that terminology of spectrum is super apparent when we're watching this back with fresh eyes, because you see how we started on one end of the spectrum and now we're at a more investigative or informational delivery system of the spectrum, where we collected all of this stuff and now we're disseminating it.
We might have believed more suspicious things about people like that at different times during the documentary. I think that's kind of why it's in there. It's not because we think it's true now. It's because, well, we might have believed it then, maybe a lot of people did, and now it's not true. If you're following the case, you know it's not true now.
And it's really therapeutic in a way to watch how we've gone through all of this and started one way and come out the other side, because while we didn't 100% believe certain theories, we definitely considered everything and we were open to everything. And to just watch how the podcast and the community involvement and all the feedback, including with the family and with law enforcement, to see how that all formulated or molded what we're doing today is really reassuring to me.
From Ian, why are you not discussing A, the possibility of Maura dying in an overdose with friends around, and then they panicked and never talked about it, or B, the possibility that she's a Jane Doe death in another state?
I gotta say, Ian, I do appreciate the use of A, B, C. I love bullet points and categorized emails like that. The second one, B, the possibility that she's a Jane Doe death in another state, we've actually discussed whether or not, you know, we don't really discuss that too intensely on the show, but internally, especially with Maggie. Maggie has these statistics, Maggie Freeling from The Disappearance of Maura Murray. She's a very big advocate of the Jane Does and the unnamed victims that are in the databases. So we do have statistics on that, and we do consider that very much.
Yeah, and there are people who check that, I think we check into Does in Vermont especially, periodically, and I know other people in the community do as well, because Vermont was, I don't know how many miles, but very close to where Maura went missing.
Yeah. The first one, A, the possibility of Maura dying of an overdose and the friend she was with panicked and hit the body. If you start discussing that, then you just run the risk of discussing all sorts of possibilities and wasting a lot of time.
Yeah, I like to call that one the I Know What You Did Last Summer corollary, because it actually comes up in a lot of missing persons cases. You hear rumors about that.
Yeah.
We've heard it in Brianna Maitland. I've heard it about Molly Bish, who was very young, and it's just hard to even believe that that could be possible.
Yep.
But these are rumors and things that are spoken about, and I think it's honestly because people have a hard time believing that there could be a monster in their midst.
That's very true. One thing that we try not to do here is take up episode time discussing theories that really don't have any connective tissue as well. And there's no real connection between Maura partying with a group of people and overdosing and dying and having those people dispose of her body. I mean, that's introducing at the very least one other person, at the most, who knows, right? A dozen people. And that's a lot of people that can form together for a conspiracy to cover up a murder.
Yeah.
That's a very difficult thing to keep quiet.
It's a lot. It's definitely something we've talked about over the years, something we've heard a lot of people mentioned in these party scenarios. So if you know something about a party like this that did exist, please email us at missingmaura murray@gmail.com, because if there's some truth to that, we'd love to hear it. But to our knowledge, we found no evidence to support that. Welcome back to Missing More Amari, Maggie Freeling. How are you today, Maggie?
I'm awesome. How are you guys?
We're doing pretty well. We wanted to have you on again and go over our weekend up in New Hampshire, where we sent some cadaver dogs around certain properties, and you were unable to make it. So we wanted to have a public debrief with you on what our findings were.
Yeah, I can't wait. I, you know, we were texting a little bit this weekend, but I don't know much. So update me.
So the first thing that we did was I headed up there on Friday to meet with Ed and Graham from GB Geotechnics and to check into the Airbnb that we rented. Met up with those two guys and we talked that night about what we were planning on doing with their GPR technology for the next day.
Okay.
Followed by a terrifying story from Ed.
So then on Saturday morning, we met up over at Rick's old place.
Rick Forcier's.
Guy right on the corner there, one of the closest houses to where Maura went missing.
And that morning, we actually got an email from the person who had connected us with the dog handler. And he had said that there were people from the Boots on the Ground community that had employed the dog handler to search some properties and some areas for them. So the dog handler felt like she was being pulled in a few different directions. And
No pun intended.
And it seemed like we might not have dogs for that day. But our guy Travis, who had been connecting us with Deb, worked out the entire arrangement, and we spoke with Barbara from the Boots on the Ground community.
That's right.
And we came together and basically said, we're all doing the same thing here. There's no reason to monopolize the dog.
Yeah, and there was some kind of miscommunication between all the channels, I think, involved. And so Deb had sort of been double booked, I guess, in some sort of way, because we were under the impression when we were heading up there that we had the dog. And we didn't even actually know about the Boots on the Ground search group being up there the same weekend until earlier that week. We started hearing some rumblings about dogs, and then we found out that morning that it was like, oh, well, now all of a sudden we don't even know if we're going to get dogs to use on Rick's old place or the A-frame. And so that was a bit of a tense moment, but then we worked it out and we met on the property up there and just talked it out, and it wasn't a big deal at all. It was actually is lovely working with like-minded people.
Yeah, and it really goes to show what happens when communication just takes place. Good
right.
Communication takes place, and there's no need to feel like, you know, you're an army of one trying to do something. Everybody's in it together. And I think Barbara said something like that. She said, all for the greater cause or something.
Yeah.
And really, that's true. And Maggie, we're talking about Deb from the Oxygen Show. So you're familiar
with
her.
Yeah, Deb is great. Did she have the dogs that were on the show, or was it different dogs?
She had Eisen.
Eisen, yeah. Eisen was great.
Yeah, great dog. Really impressive. So the first thing we saw with the dog was at the A-frame.
So we split up and tried to make the best of our time and utilize as much time and as possible. And the dogs first went to the A-frame. And you went with them, and what did you see there?
Yeah, we even have some GoPro footage of it. And so I kind of followed Deb and Eisen, the dog, with the GoPro into the woods surrounding the entire property and then into the house. And we were under the impression that the dog would stop if there was some kind of smell of decomposition, decomposing humans, to be more specific, or human. And the dog had a lot of bells around its neck tied to it.
Around like its collar?
Yeah, kind of like a Santa Claus on a sleigh or something like that. So you know, you can actually tell by looking at the dog or listening whether there's a hit or not.
Right, because when there's a hit for the decomposing biomatter, the dog sits down.
Yeah, there would be no bells.
Yep.
Right, that's what happened in the show when the dog found the placenta we buried.
Right. Yep. Okay.
Yep.
And so then we went inside the A-frame house, and the dog, Eisen, walked all three floors of the property, not being interested in any single part of the entire property.
Had no interest. That was pretty much Deb's words, right?
The door to the downstairs closet was opened, and Eisen stuck his or her nose, a little snout, right in there and just kept moving on. And even I was a little taken aback at the moment. It was like, oh, well, maybe we should check this out further. And Deb asked before we started, by the way. She was like, I don't want to know anything. I know nothing about anything in this house. So don't tell me anything about what areas or whatnot.
Sorry, I'm confused. This is the A-frame?
Yes. But I almost stopped her at that moment to say, oh, maybe we should have Eisen sniff a little bit more in here. But I realized that if the dog had no interest at all, there was no chance of decomposing human in that closet at any point.
It's such a small area. If he stuck his nose in and didn't smell anything, then there wasn't anything there.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he needs like a deep scent necessarily. It was my understanding anyway.
Right. So we'll go over what happened and then we'll go over some of the updates as well.
Sure.
So you know, the update of the closet just based on the phone conversation that we had this morning with a member of law enforcement.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
In the meantime, we're over at the at Forcier's old home, and we're sending the fiber optic camera on a cable down into the well, which isn't really a well in the sense of a, you know, old turn of the century type or turn of the 1900s type well where the bucket comes up. It's about an 8-inch in diameter iron pipe that drops down to at least 135 feet. We got the camera down to about 130 feet, but there was a bunch of sediment at the bottom, and we watched the footage the entire way down, and we have video of that footage as well.
That's right. So,
okay,
a camera. What camera was sent down there?
It was a camera that was attached to a long cable on a spool, on a giant spool that you could spin, and it was the same type of camera that you can send into a wall.
Yeah.
Probably about the diameter of maybe like a Sharpie.
Okay. And
with a light on the end.
Wow. Okay. And so the footage was pretty good and you were watching that live on a laptop.
Yeah. Right. And it was recorded at the same time, but we were watching it live and it was going down into the depths of this iron pipe. Yeah, all the way down 130 something feet, a bunch of sediment all around it. We thought for a little bit if we let the sediment settle, mm-hmm. then we could see better, but that ended up just settling around the camera. We couldn't see anything. So actually, the more you moved it around, the better it was.
Oh, interesting.
We found nothing down there, and there was plenty of little connections that have like sort of an X brace that we had to slip the camera through.
Right.
So if anything was dropped down there, it would have caught up on one of those braces.
Right, so it would have been caught up earlier and you probably would have seen it as
yeah,
you passed it.
As
with
it passed
camera.
With the camera.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So chances someone dropped something down, something, you know, bigger than a quarter down there is pretty much zero.
If you're talking something like a cell phone being dropped down there, it would have caught up on one of those braces.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm.
And then we started digging up the lawn, looking at that anomalous area from the summer that we found.
That's right. But before that, we actually had to put a halt to that digging because we were asked by Deb and Travis to kind of let the other property sit for as long as we could, to where there's this, you know, few amount of footsteps, people walking on the grass on the property, so the dog can kind of get a clearer scent if possible. So we came back and kind of we stopped the digging, and then we were kind of down for like an hour or a half an hour waiting, and the dog came back with Deb, and what happened?
Came back and searched the inside of the house, which we had done some of the handheld GPR on the ground to identify the hollow spot that AJ and Mina had discovered. And they didn't find anything with the GPR that was unusual. Looks like the tiling was on top of cement, which was on top of sort of a lumber grid. So it makes sense that you'd probably have some hollow sounds there.
Okay.
Interesting.
Thankfully, because to rip that up would be a disruption of their entire lives for who knows how long.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm sure they're so happy that there's nothing at their house.
Yeah, there's nothing inside the house. The dog went through, didn't sit down anywhere, went through pretty quickly, came outside, went around the property, and Deb came back up to us and said that she, for the most part, will clear this property, but she said the dog was busy all around the property and then went to the side of the house back where the three sheds or shanties are. And right next to the house, pretty much right adjacent to the house, there's a small mound of earth. And she said that it was the only time that she had seen him behave differently. And she said, again, it wasn't a significant change in behavior. And she wasn't trying to be an alarmist or raise any flags. She just said, as long as you have the GPR, I would stop doing the GPR over there and I'd have them run the GPR over here because it's the only area where he was interested in something. And that could be runoff from a leach field or, maybe Mina had said that further back in the woods, they throw like chicken bones from rotisserie chickens and stuff. So maybe it was something like that, but it was the only change in behavior.
I think they're trained really to react on human,
human, right. Composition. So I don't think it would be chicken bones.
Decomp. Yeah.
Right.
So, this wasn't like known, and it was actually kind of made really apparent that it wasn't like an official hit. Like, don't call this a hit.
She went out of her way to say that Eisen did not have a hit. It was just
It was just a weird behavior.
A slight change in behavior.
Right.
She wouldn't even go so far as to say unusual. She just said
okay.
It was the only time he'd behaved differently. And even that was probably something that only she could recognize. His change in behavior.
And so the spot that we had identified, did he go near that? Like, nothing.
Oh, nothing. Nothing. And we did take the GPR over to the spot where he acted a little differently, and they said that it looked all normal. It was all normal earth for the most part, but it was sort of so uneven that they couldn't get a distinct reading. So we will follow up with the state police and see if they have time to get their dogs over there as well at some point to rule it out.
Yeah.
So did you guys dig in the spot that we found?
We didn't dig. Graham dug.
The soil whisperer.
The soil whisperer dug.
And, right.
And
naturally.
Dug. And dug. Yeah. And dug.
Yeah, he dug quite an impressive hole.
About 3 feet at the max.
Yeah. And we learned that the anomaly that that read from the ground penetrating radar was mostly a collection of large boulders.
Yeah.
Mm.
But the question still was, like, why are all these boulders kind of grouped up right here? And so it was like, well, maybe there's something underneath the boulders, because it still kind of seemed like someone went in from the top. So something could have been put down there and then boulders thrown on top of it and then the dirt piled on even more. But we did that. Graham and Ed, they dug to the bottom of that boulder formation, and that was it.
Pulled up some of the boulders and didn't see anything underneath. As a matter of fact, aside from the boulder part, Graham said that you couldn't fake the earth to look more normal. So that's the digging.
What we tried to do is we tried to kind of dig on the edges of the anomaly. That way we could try and catch a boundary in the soil. And that would be, clearly indicative of something that had been dug. We really didn't see that as we were going. Sometimes, you just miss it. We're digging pretty aggressively. But as we're traveling down, we're seeing still nice, clean, undamaged layers. All the way down, we're 2.5, almost 3 feet deep over here. Once we kind of clear the rest of this out, that'll be almost 4 feet deep, which is, I think, below anything that we could really see that we thought was interesting. Once you get all the way down here, then you reach kind of a not actually like pea gravel that you would find in a like a playground, but just really, really small, kind of fine rock. The soil is really nicely marbled, and what that means is that it's naturally occurring. There's GPR just kind of showed us the anomaly, and that anomaly turned out to just be kind of a lot of rocks scattering the signal. So that's mystery solved.
And it was kind of an interesting feeling, not one that we had before, in going up there and doing like this boots on the ground, so to speak, kind of work. This is the first time we didn't create any actionable leads afterwards. So it's kind of like a little bit of a back to the drawing board moment.
And so the property that Fred identified for me, we have, you know, this weekend you guys weren't able to go there. Are we making plans in the future?
Yes, we weren't able to go to this other property because it's still unclear whether or not it's private property or public property, or maybe some property that hunters lease out so that they can hunt on it. The closest house there, we have the contact information, just the name of the owner of the closest house. But pretty tough to get in touch with if you're not knocking on the door and their home. So it just didn't feel right. Deb was very adamant, rightfully so, about going onto properties that didn't have strict permission. But that was the only property that we just couldn't get the permission on in time. And not for lack of trying. It's just really hard to find who owns a random plot of land.
Yeah.
Right. And what about Curtis? Did he come up to do that other place?
Yeah, Curtis came up to do the other place on the Haverhill Bath line. His flight ended up being delayed to the point where he didn't come up until later on that night. So that location was done the next day. But even the next day, his GPS device in his car malfunctioned and sent him like an hour and a half in the wrong direction before he realized he was going in the wrong direction. So we did end up going over there and running the dogs around, and the dog found nothing as well, which was really impressive because we know for a fact, speaking with the selectmen over there and with law enforcement, that there was a fire there and a couple of dogs perished in the fire, and Eisen is trained to differentiate between a deceased dog and a human being, and didn't even hit on the dog.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But nothing was found there. And then the next day, Ed and Graham went back with their GPR to that location, ran over it, found nothing but a giant root, dug in a couple of spots and found nothing.
So thorough. Like, it's so crazy. I mean, we've gone up there so many times. We've brought GPRs and dogs and dug. And I mean, it makes me feel good that there's really nothing at these properties.
Yeah, and it makes the homeowners feel pretty good.
Yeah.
Here's one thing that I will put out there that we just learned about the dogs. If anybody plans on going up there and digging because you think that there's something in a location, it's much better to get the dogs there first, because if you dig, and I love this little detail, if you dig, then it disrupts the decomposition, the odor of the decomposition below the surface. And if you dig, that suddenly dissipates into the air, and you need to wait months for that to reconcentrate again for the dogs to get a scent. So if you dig, and let's say you're right, you're somewhat accurate, and you're close, but you don't find anything, you've ruined the scent for months. So a dog could go up there a week later and find nothing.
Right.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I definitely never thought about that, never even knew that, but the visual there actually works in my head, so I get that.
Sure, and besides that, I mean, digging, assuming there was human elements, I mean, you're totally disrupting a crime scene and disturbing anything that might be there.
Yeah, if you do have plans to go up there and do something like that, contact us, contact the police. They're not open to these things.
Now, the last thing that we did, or I should say kind of tried to do, was on Sunday at the A-frame, and we tried to use some luminol as we heard Mike, the old owner, describe when he sprayed luminol in the downstairs closet. It pulled up and lit up like a Christmas tree. And so we didn't have so much luck, I think, just with the product, probably being the only time we ever attempted such a thing. But the good news is that we heard through our friend Travis, we heard from someone in law enforcement currently who kind of gave us some tips on doing a luminol test and may even accompany us if we try to do this again. But also, probably the most interesting thing that this person said, and that we've learned about this clausin in luminol, is that bleach will give you a false positive. Not to mention some herbs.
Yes, horseradish, rosemary, thyme.
What about marijuana?
Yep,
I like where your head's at, Maggie. But yes.
Well, that definitely looks like a grow closet. That's what we all thought when we looked at the closet.
Yep. And we specifically asked this member of law enforcement as he was telling us the things that would give a false positive. We said, you know, everyone looked at this closet and here's what it looks like. And we described it and we said that it sort of looked like a grow closet to us. Would marijuana be, you know, would affect the test, and would that give a false positive? And we barely said that, and he started saying, "Oh yeah, yeah, yeah." He goes, "Not only the marijuana, but maybe some of the chemicals they use, or like the pesticides that they would use on it, or the fertilizer, or whatever, like the products they would use to help it grow, would give a false positive."
And just to reiterate, in this really dark closet, that is cocked, like the edges
in between the stairs that run over it.
Everywhere, every corner is cocked in there, and it has a light bulb about waist high when you walk in, and that is the only light bulb in the closet. So it's a light bulb fixture on the wall about waist high,
and then a padlock latch lock on the outside.
It also had a crucifix.
It did. It did. Well, you know, Jesus,
and it said. Private, but
Jesus liked
420.
I mean, outside of the disappearance of Maura Murray, if you looked at that closet in that location in New Hampshire, you'd look at it, and the first thing you'd say is, "Oh, it's cocked from the inside. It's locked from the outside. There's access to a light bulb here. It just looks like a grow closet."
Yeah,
it totally looked like a grow closet. Totally.
So it would seem that the closet in the A-frame house is officially ruled out as far as this, amateur investigation goes. But I do think we are going to try to do a luminol test up there at some point and just, you know, see what happens.
We pretty much figured out that we were not luminol experts. I'll fall on the sword there. I bought the luminol. Just turned out to be something that you'd show your eighth grade science class that you put this powder in water and it lights up blue. That was super embarrassing too. We were there and we were like, well, maybe if we let it die down and then spray. And then we wanted to run a control test, and our camera guy Joshua F. Leonard said, "Oh, I have this cut on my hand," and he starts gouging at his own hand with a key to try to get blood, and he did. So we wiped some of his own blood. So Josh has given blood, sweat, and tears to this project.
Yeah, on a piece of paper. Then we sprayed the piece of paper. We just wanted to see if that glowed more than the floor glowed. So it was just a mess. So we are not
Luminatis.
Yeah, we are Luminat experts.
Luminat.
but try again, we will.
So you guys tried the luminol on your own, like not with an expert. You guys just like bought luminol.
That's correct. We actually bought luminol that would be good for like if we were going to change the A-frame into like a rave for a night.
Right.
Right. Okay. Right. 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 So I saw luminol work. I don't think we had it in the show because it was hard to capture on camera, but I saw it work in the show and it worked.
If done correctly, I'm sure it works great.
Yeah, the same guy who did the blood testing, he came and showed us how luminol works and turned off the lights, and it was like exactly what you see in forensic files. It was like, oh my God, here is this gigantic stain. But again, luminol, you know, I think people always get this wrong that it's blood. I mean, it's not going to just react on blood. So yeah, I think what we did was like someone spit on a towel and we sprayed the luminol, you know, like I think it was like that. But yeah, so, I mean, that's so interesting that marijuana plants would cause luminol to light up. Did you get the science behind that? Like, why?
I think just the chemicals in it. I have no idea. Yeah. I don't know if he really knew. He just knew from his experience that it would happen.
So, yeah, the whole kind of weekend sort of left us with a feeling like kind of like an anxious feeling, but almost like that we lost like a round in a boxing match.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's kind of like back to the drawing board. You know, where can we go from here?
Well, I still, you know, I absolutely want to see if we can get in touch with the people of that property Fred showed us. I mean, that to me seemed really promising. I mean, it's somewhere that, you know, a specific person hunted at. It's a vast property. It was never actually searched, because from what we know, you know, the dogs searched somewhat nearby, but didn't actually go that way. Yeah, so that's of interest to me.
I want to make a clarification here. We were alerted to a message that was posted on one of the one of Maura Murray's Facebook groups, and someone, I don't know if it was a spy, I'm not sure how this happened, but someone pinpointed a lot of details that happened while we were there. I just want to clarify this person's this post.
Yeah.
This person says that Chuck West, well, first of all, the person says that he can confirm that Tim and myself were at the A-frame. We were. We were also at Rick Forsey's old place. And then he goes on to say Chuck West was with them for part of the trip. That's not true. Nope. Chuck West was not there for part of the trip. And then he goes on to say that the search dog in quotations, which I don't know why they put the search dog in quotations. This was a legit cadaver dog.
Yeah.
Search in quotations is weird. It was a trained cadaver dog. This was not a hit. It says a possible hit in Forsier's backyard right behind the house near a mound of dirt. Not accurate. It was the side of the house. It wasn't a mound of dirt. It was sort of, I mean, I guess you could call it a mound, but it wasn't called a hit.
Yeah.
It was a mild change in the dog's behavior. And it could have been, according to Deb, it could have been a number of things that changed his behavior. What the dog did not do was sit down. So I just want to clear that up. It is true that some of the boots on the ground people were concerned about the payment for Deb. I'm not going to say what the payment was. Well, I mean, the post is here, right?
You don't have
it's
to.
Wrong.
It's wrong.
It's wrong. Yeah.
So, but there are details that are true.
I'm really confused. This is a post where? What is this?
It's on Facebook. And you know, we just are addressing general speculation out there that you know, people wrote on Facebook and is being circulated throughout the community. And
wait, so this is some random internet person who was like spying on you guys?
Well, we have no idea what the situation is, but we're just trying to nip the inaccuracies in the bud right here.
Right.
So we're not going to put the person's name out there. But if you're in the group, you probably know who it is or whatnot.
And I wouldn't say this if they didn't bring Chuck West into it and if they didn't bring in the GoFundMe money. So a couple of the members of the Boots on the Ground group were concerned about the payment for Deb. We're not going to say how much she charges, but it was a very reasonable amount. And they had spoken to us about it, and we said, well, we knew that this was going to cost money, so we brought money up here to pay Deb. You shouldn't be taking it out of your own pocket if we've started this GoFundMe. And
That's what it's for.
And the general consensus, the overall consensus, was after we did the GPR, people said, let's get the dogs in there now. So that's what we did. And it that is what that money is for. So, yes, there was cash that was given to Deb. It is not the amount that is in this. What's weird about it is that they actually specify how I delivered the money. I reached into my car, and I had it in an envelope, and that's how I delivered the money.
It's weird that that part's right, but the amount is wrong.
Right, exactly. Like,
this is hilarious. This, random person is just, like, who is this person, this is so ridiculous.
I think just the point is just to correct the inaccuracies, and we want to be very clear that Chuck West was not there with us.
And I mean, I'll say that there were some comments just thanking us for doing it.
Yeah.
You know, and kind of identifying that this person's sort of making nothing out of, yeah, sort of making a lot out of nothing.
Yeah, I don't get the spitefulness in it, but maybe I read it wrong. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, they asked the question. They said after identifying that it was me that went to the car to pay for it, yes, I did go to my car and gave cash to the dog handler for it.
But what does it matter? You're paying a dog handler for this thing that you're doing because you want to be doing this. Like, where does this person's point? Like, they clearly just have an obsession with you and Tim. Like, that's it.
Yeah. Take a number, man. Seriously. but he did ask the question, where did those funds come from? Those funds came from the GoFundMe that people have directed us to get the dogs and use that funds for.
Right. So. And that was probably the whole point of the thing is, where is this money? What's going on with this money? And I don't think, the money is sitting in the account. Like, I don't think there's been much used. There's been some paid to Deb. There was some to rent the Airbnb. But I mean, there's not much else that it's been spent on so far. Some of the testing, everything else we've talked about on the podcast.
Yeah,
already.
Yeah. General expenses to get up there, the accommodations, the dogs, the testing, incidentals like, you know, crowbars and stuff like that. But yeah. I mean, it's being used. It's being used for exactly what we said it was being used for.
So, yeah.
There you go. Where did those funds come from?
There you go.
Came from the GoFundMe money, which came from the community of hundreds of people who donated.
The incredible community who has donated.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.